Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. There are new developments in the investigation into allegations of corruption surrounding the $64 billion United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq. Federal prosecutors in New York have issued indictments and a criminal complaint outlining some complicated financial maneuvering and alleged attempts to bribe UN officials involved with the program. Joining us from New York is Colm Lynch. He's UN correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome, Colm.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, let's review the indictments briefly. First, the Texas oil company, Bay Oil USA, Inc. Tell us about that company and who is indicted and what this is all about.
Yeah, basically the first case is the only indictment. The other one's a criminal complaint. But essentially what it is, this is a company, a Houston-based company run by a guy named Dave Chalmers, whose relationship with the Saddam Hussein's regime goes way back before the sanctions. And essentially, at a time when Saddam Hussein was driving all these other American companies out of the business, Bay Oil continued to sort of trade with the regime, and there were always questions about what sort of special relationship did it have with the regime that allowed it to continue to do business. Now we're beginning to find out.
Mm-hmm. And basically, they're charged then with, can you explain the scheme briefly?
Yeah, essentially what they're charged with is they are charged with conspiring with the Iraqi government to try and keep prices of oil low. And they also are charged with channeling millions of dollars worth of bribes, either directly through companies that were given vouchers to buy oil, or from, you know, companies that they passed on the oil to. So they were sort of doing it from a variety of different angles.
And what would be the point of discounting the price of the oil?
Essentially, what you want to do is you want to, in order for a company to, you know, be able to give kickbacks, there has to be a low price so that there's enough profit so that they can give back enough money to satisfy the regime while ensuring that they make money off of the deal. So the idea was to try and put pressure on the UN to keep the prices, because the UN approved the oil prices, so to keep it as low as possible. And they worked very aggressively at trying to achieve that.
And the criminal complaint, that involves Tung Sung Park, the South Korean businessman.
Yeah, this is a guy who's been around Washington for many years. He was involved in a influence peddling scandal back in the 1970s, had some connections with South Korean intelligence, was famous for passing $20,000 envelopes to congressmen in the 1970s to sort of buy their influence. He is now sort of charged. It's not an indictment. He hasn't been charged by a grand jury, but essentially what these charges alleges that when they set up this UN Oil for Food deal back in the mid-1990s, that he was sort of brought on as a kind of unregistered agent, an unregistered lobbyist on behalf of the Iraqi government to try and use his influence on UN officials, or allegations that he may have tried to bribe some UN officials. And he would try and, you know, convince them to sort of create a program that had lots of gaps in it that allowed the Iraqis to sort of manipulate the program and to sort of exercise as much control over the way that program was run as possible.
Mm-hmm. And it's only attempting to bribe a UN official. At this point, there's nothing to suggest that a UN official may have accepted payment or even agreed to.
Well, there's nothing that says that they accepted. There are a series of, sort of detailed descriptions of how he solicited funds from the Iraqi government, and there was an understanding, a broad understanding between the people who were involved in this transaction that some of that money was going to go to a certain UN official. There's another allegation that he invested $1 million in the company of a son of a senior high-ranking official in Canada. That would have been money that was sort of given by the Iraqis to Park to invest in this kid's, in this official son's company in Canada. So, you know, there may be sort of more evidence on that side that money actually changed hands in some way.
So it sounds as if we're just hearing about maybe the beginning of what might be a very lengthy investigation into this whole thing.
Yeah, it looks like it's going on for quite a bit longer. And, of course, here at the UN, we're quite interested in finding out who these UN officials are, and it's not clear at this point who they are.
All right. Well, Colm, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. Thanks much.
Colm Lynch is a reporter for The Washington Post. And this note, In Iraq today, three bombs went off in Baghdad, killing at least one civilian and wounding eight others. Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for one of those attacks. Also, the Iraqi government has discovered more mass graves in the southern part of the country. It says one of the sites contains an estimated 5,000 bodies of Iraqi soldiers believed to have joined a failed uprising against Saddam Hussein after the Persian Gulf War. Ahead of the largest and most international papal conclave in Rome on Monday, security experts are tearing open cushions in the apartments where cardinals are staying. They're even inspecting water taps to make sure there are no listening devices that might leak information about the man who will be chosen to be the next pope. The conclave rituals appear medieval. Secret ballots, special chalices, and white smoke rising from the Vatican announcing when the next pope has been selected. Even though cardinals promise never to reveal details of the conclave and they face excommunication if they do, there are reports about potential frontrunners. Italian media have suggested conservative German cardinal Joseph Ratzinger is gaining support, and at least one Irish bookie watching the papal race says the odds in favor of Ratzinger are 3-1. Joining us on the line from Rome is historian Anthony Melanti, whose forthcoming book is called The Families Who Made Rome. And Anthony, it's sounding like a soccer game with two big voting blocks of 20 cardinals each, the Italians and the Latin Americans. Is that how the voting might play out?
Well, the alliances first and foremost will probably be between the Pope's own appointees, the recent Pope's appointees, and the ones who have at certain points dissented from his opinion. The Church has two really strong twin pillars of teaching, a theological teaching and a social teaching. And it's possible that the people who agree on social issues together will form a bloc.
And which cardinals do you think might play a key role?
Well, the most highly visible cardinals are the ones who are the most natural leaders. They're the ones who are the opinion makers in a certain sense, because they're the ones who've been in the public eye for a long time. It's important to remember that most cardinals don't really know each other before the conclave, because they're in their dioceses or they're doing all kinds of other things all around the world. It's not like they eat dinner together every night. And so in order to elect someone who has the right qualifications, you have to find out what they are. Obviously, the cardinals who are the most high-profile ones have a head start on this. So we're looking at Cardinal Ratzinger, for example, who is the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and other prominent cardinals, not necessarily as prime candidates, but as opinion formers.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, one historian wrote, "We know less about the conclaves of the 20th century than we do about those of the 16th century." Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. The conclaves of the modern era are shrouded in secrecy. Even in the 16th century, though, there's a lot more speculation than there is fact. The only one really vivid account of a papal election that we have comes from the 15th century, and it was written in the autobiography of Pope Pius II, and he describes an incredibly sordid series of maneuverings in the chambers where they would elect the pope, but this is before the Sistine Chapel was built. Nighttime plots in the latrines, for example, which produced people coming to wake up the cardinal who became Pope, Pius II, saying, "You know, we must go off to the latrines and make bargains with the people who are now agreeing upon who is going to become Pope." And of course, the virtuous cardinal who became Pope rolled over and said, "Oh, that's an appropriate place for such a foul bargain," and went back to sleep. And in the end, that pope was elected by a combination of methods, first via the scrutiny, in other words, a secret ballot, but then when there wasn't a necessary two-thirds consensus, then you could acclaim the pope. In other words, you could sit down and actually state, "I accede to such and such a cardinal," and that meant you gave him his vote.
So do the cardinals publicly declare who they're supporting?
No longer. The scrutiny as a method of papal election was fixed by Gregory XV in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be public.
Even within the conclave, they don't declare who they're supporting?
No.
Hmm.
Although I suspect that during the discussions that lead up to a vote, it becomes relatively clear who's on whose side.
But outright campaigning would seem unseemly, yes?
Absolutely. No, you're meant to be extremely modest. When you're elected pope, you really have to ask yourself, are your shoulders strong enough to bear the burden? And it is an extremely lonely job, and it's not one that every cardinal would necessarily want. So the result is that campaigning is distinctly frowned upon, and it's almost it would almost be guaranteed to have a negative effect. The less you seem to want it, in fact, the more likely it is that you'll get it.
There are two candidates who've been described as leading candidates. As you mentioned, Cardinal Ratzinger, and he published a book this week, Values in a Time of Upheaval, and it condemns gay marriage and divorce, calls on Europe to return to its Christian roots. Some Vatican watchers say that he's too powerful to become pope, and perhaps he is too public in his appearances here. What do you think?
Well, I'm inclined to agree. Cardinal Ratzinger has been in the public eye for such a long time. He has been the right-hand man of John Paul II for most of the post-pontificate. And as a result, he's stepped on a lot of toes. He certainly expresses a strong viewpoint that is shared by many other cardinals. But to have Cardinal Ratzinger elected as pope seems extremely unlikely.
So the Italian media reports saying that he may have the votes, do you put any stock in those reports?
No, absolutely not. The Italian media is passionately attached to what they call dietrologia, behindology. They're always curious to know, get behind the scenes, but if they can't get the proper insights or the proper sources, they'll cheerfully make something up.
What about the reports that say that there's opposition support coalescing around the former Archbishop of Milan, Carlo Maria Martini?
Well, that's also interesting, and Martini is an interesting character, first of all, because he's something of a social liberal, and also because, as former Archbishop of Milan, he holds a bishopric that has historically produced popes in greater numbers than other archbishoprics, like, for example, Paul VI, who is the pope just before John Paul I, was former Archbishop of Milan. Not only that, but in contrast to Ratzinger, he has a lot of experience pastorally. He has the experience of being a bishop ministering to a flock rather than simply being a paper pusher and a theologian, which is what Ratzinger is. Ratzinger is a super intellectual, whereas Martini has got his finger more on the pulse of the human interaction, which is very important. But Martini is also totally unlikely. For the simple reason, first of all, he's a Jesuit, and Jesuits never get elected pope because they have a very bad reputation amongst the other cardinals for being difficult, too independent. Secondly, his own liberal teachings tell against him. Thirdly, he's pretty old, so if you wanted to hire someone who was going to be an interim pope, they might elect him. But at the same time, if you wanted someone who was going to make any lasting changes, perhaps he might not be a good choice.
We're speaking with historian Anthony Maionlotti, author of the forthcoming book, The Families Who Made Rome. When we return, how the push for sainthood for Pope John Paul II might affect the conclave. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about the papal conclave. After prayers on Monday, 115 cardinals will be shut behind the oak doors of the Sistine Chapel. And exactly what goes on under Michelangelo's frescoes may never be known, other than the fact that one of the men will be elected pope. We're speaking with historian Anthony Maionlotti. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Families Who Made Rome. Anthony, there's been a lot of talk about cardinals choosing a European pope versus one from another region, say Latin America. What's now being said about that?
Well, I think it's important to consider that there's a strong faction inside the European cardinalate that wants the cardinalate to express the will of the entire world. In other words, to open it up to a wider constituency of cardinals. But at the same time, there's also a conservative element, especially within the huge power block of the Italian cardinals, who number 20, to elect another European, if possible Italian. it's really difficult to say. Of the foreign cardinals, the non-European cardinals, a tendency to favor the Latin American ones rather than the Asian ones or the African ones. A speculation that we used to see all the time about African Cardinal Francis Arinze, for example, has totally disappeared out of the media, which, of course, doesn't mean that it's disappeared out of the minds of the cardinals who are making the choice. In the end, I think the important thing to remember is the old cynical Roman saying, he who enters the conclave a pope leaves it a cardinal. In other words, the favored candidate never wins.
So any ideas about who might emerge?
Well, I'm keeping an eye on the Cardinal Archbishop of São Paulo of Brazil, Cardinal Claudio Humes, who seems to have managed to bridge both socially conservative and socially liberal doctrines and during the course of his archbishopric. He replaced an extremely left-wing archbishop, and he made it clear he wasn't going to be that left-wing. At the same time, he's always been in favor of trade unions, and that gives him a certain amount of credit with the liberal wing of the cardinals. At the same time, he's been a very loyal doctrinal follower of John Paul II, which means he might appeal to the hardliners. But there's something else that I wanted to point out, which is that John Paul II changed the rules of the conclave. It used to be that you always had to get, without exception, a two-thirds majority of the votes in the College of Cardinals to be elected. Now, in order to speed everything up, John Paul II changed the rules to say that after 30 scrutinies, in other words, after 30 separate votes, you could throw away the two-thirds rule, and it would be 50% plus one to elect a pope. So this simply means that if there is a majority of hardline cardinals, for example, who don't have quite enough to make a two-thirds majority, they could just more or less go through the motions of voting 30 times, knowing that at the end of it, the 31st scrutiny, they could elect the person that they like with only 50% plus one. So it may be that in this way, John Paul II's changing of the rules is the most significant new element in the mix. And it also might mean that we'll see a longer conclave than we used to.
Longer?
Yes. Well, in the last several conclaves, they haven't lasted longer than 5 days. This could last as long as 10 days.
Also, there's also the push for sainthood for the late Pope John Paul II. Do you think that affects what's happening?
Well, it's in everyone's interest to talk about John Paul II as a saint. First of all, there's an unexpectedly huge popular upswell of sentiment in his favor. Secondly, the popes, cardinals, the ones who he appointed, have a stock in having him a saint, because if a saint appoints you cardinal, you can't be that bad. And generally speaking, it looks like there's nothing in the way of making the pope, the late pope, a saint as quickly as possible. But as quickly as possible isn't that quick, because the sainthood is a serious thing. Even John Paul II, who expedited and streamlined the sanctification process, didn't make it last less than 5 years. And I don't think that rule would be broken for the late pope.
During the conclave, do they conduct their discussions in Latin? What language?
No, in fact, they do their best to communicate as best they can with each other, which means they use the lingua franca of the Vatican City, which, much as we would all like to believe it's Latin, is bound to be Italian.
I also understand that when a decision is made, despite all the electronic technology we have, it's still going to be white smoke.
Yes, well, that's the whole point of the church, is that it doesn't kowtow to modern trends. It will constantly use the same methods, although it has unbent to the degree that it will now ring the bells as well as send up the white smoke so that we can tell with our ears as well as our eyes. Considering that the upcoming days look like they're going to be really bad weather, maybe that's a good idea.
So any predictions? Maybe 10 days, and any predictions on who?
Oh, I absolutely can't answer that question. But I think that it's bound to be someone who can unite the different factions in order to keep the church in a more or less unified state at this extremely delicate position in its history.
All right, Anthony, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Deborah.
Historian Anthony Maianlotti is the author of The Families Who Made Rome, which is due out next month. As always, we welcome your thoughts about our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and the town you're from. Next week on Here and Now, Tony Blair's Labour Party is widely expected to win re-election in Britain's national election next month. Has Blair managed to regain the ground he lost over the war in Iraq? Also, on the road with an ultra-marathon man. Running 26 miles is just a warm-up for him. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Here and Now. What if the next nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court believes that much of the past 70 years of constitutional thought is wrong? And what if that person thinks it's time to turn back the clock? That's exactly what a group of libertarian thinkers, lawyers, and politicians called the Constitution in Exile movement would like to see. Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University. He writes about the Constitution in Exile movement in the cover story of this weekend's New York Times magazine. And he spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Professor, let me ask you, first of all, what is the Constitution in Exile movement?
It's a movement that seeks to resurrect limits on federal and state power that have been dormant since the New Deal. Essentially, members of this movement think that the Supreme Court was wrong in 1937 to decide that when it comes to economic regulations, the government should have broad discretion to do whatever it likes. And these scholars and judges and activists want courts to resurrect judicial activism on behalf of what they call economic liberties, which would mean striking down much of the post-New Deal regulatory state.
Well, give me an example of something the movement's particularly perturbed about.
They don't like environmental laws very much, not because they like smog, but because they think that having the federal government impose limitations on smog and so forth violates various technical constitutional doctrines. So, for example, parts of the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act might be called into question by this movement. More ambitiously, independent agencies like the Federal Reserve and the Social Security Administration could be under not only political but also constitutional stress. And the extreme version of the movement, if it came to pass, might even call into question minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, and zoning regulations as well.
Regarding zoning regulations, in your article you talk about that the movement feels that if a local town, for example, should change a zoning law so that anyone's property might be reduced in monetary value, the local government should compensate the property owner for the difference.
That's exactly right, and it's precisely that issue that's coming up before the Supreme Court this year in a case called Kelo versus New London, Connecticut. Drawing on the work of a scholar called Richard Epstein, who's the intellectual guru of the movement, briefs filed in that case suggest that if the town of New London wants to seize by eminent domain Suzette Kelo's home, thereby reducing the value of her property, it should have to compensate her for the value that she's lost. It's a simple theory, but obviously it would be very hard to enforce most zoning regulations if every time the value of a property was reduced, there'd have to be compensation.
If the Constitution in Exile movement had its way across the board and government regulation was completely or almost completely abolished, how does it envision protections for workers, consumers, the environment, etc.?
I think members of the movement think that many protections would be arranged by private contracts. So, for example, some localities might tolerate more pollution than other ones, and if you didn't like the balance struck in your town, you could move to another one. Businesses that wanted to pollute more could sell pollution credits to those who wanted to pollute less. Now, they have different balances about regulation, and not all of them are against every form of regulation. Some forms of environmental protection they think would be covered by local ordinances.
others by private contract, but generally there'd be a dramatically reduced role for the federal government in regulating many of the things that it regulates today.
I can imagine opponents saying that it sounds like a return to early 20th century America with belching power plants across the country and water of various colors surging down rivers.
I think opponents would say that, and they would say that the constitutional jurisprudence of the Gilded Age, which really enshrined laissez-faire economics as the apotheosis of American jurisprudence, had some of the effects that you mentioned. Now, members of the movement would debate this strenuously, and as a policy matter, I think that they would claim that the world would not only be better off constitutionally, but also economically if people were free to bargain for the level of compensation and protection that their individual talents demanded. But the bulk of their movement is devoted to the constitutional principle that regardless of what the consequences are, the Constitution requires no less, and the courts have been unprincipled in abandoning these limitations on federal and state power.
How are believers in Constitution in exile trying to influence the courts?
Well, they are putting a lot of stake in the lower court nominations and, of course, the forthcoming battles to the Supreme Court if vacancies come up. So they've been lobbying quite actively on behalf of several of President Bush's judicial nominees who were resisted by Senate Democrats in the first term and have been renominated. And one person who seemed sympathetic to the tenets of the movement, William Myers, was the first judge confirmed by the Senate Judiciary on a party line vote just a couple of weeks ago.
Myers to a federal judgeship.
Exactly so. Other sympathizers of the movement who are pending before the Senate Judiciary Committee include someone called William Pryor, who's been very closely affiliated with the movement, and Janice Rogers Brown, nominated to the D.C. Circuit, who has said that 1937, the year that the Supreme Court got out of the business of policing economic regulation, was a triumph of the socialist revolution. So she's been quite a fire breather on this, and members of the movement like her a lot.
One wonders how much support the movement will have on Capitol Hill in its effort to install activist judges when judicial activism is under fire at this moment, especially from members of the Republican Party on Capitol Hill.
Well, this is a central irony, isn't it? After all, the Republican Party has been denouncing Democrats and liberals for the past 60 years for using the courts to achieve victories that they're unable to achieve in the legislative arena. And when it comes to these matters of economic liberties, the conservatives are doing precisely what they've accused their opponents of doing, unashamedly embracing judicial activism on behalf of principles that are not popular in the country as a whole. Now, whenever activism is debated, both sides accuse their opponents of being activists, and the meaning is very malleable. It keeps changing. But if you pick a neutral definition of activism, which is just any time a judge strikes down a federal or state law, he or she is being activist, then there's no question that the Constitution and exile people openly and unashamedly embrace judicial activism just as their Democratic opponents do.
If Chief Justice Rehnquist retires sometime during this year, as many court watchers expect that he will, of course that is an unknown, do you think that the White House has the political will to try and push a nominee to the Supreme Court who would be sympathetic to the movement?
I think they do. Now, the White House wouldn't know the phrase the Constitution in exile, and it wouldn't be the only thing that they'd be choosing when they pick someone, but it's surely significant that several of the names that often surface on the White House's shortlist are sympathetic to the movement in whole or in part. Judge Michael McConnell, Judge Michael Luttig, and Judge John Roberts, all lower federal appellate judges, have been embraced by the movement as people who might be sympathetic to it. So, again, it would be silly to expect 100% home run. These are complicated judges with lots of different judicial philosophies, but at least from the movement's point of view, they're pretty optimistic.
Jeffrey Rosen, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Rosen's article, The Unregulated Offensive, appears in this weekend's edition of the New York Times Magazine. Still to come, jazz pianist Hank Jones isn't letting his age keep him down. We catch up with the 86-year-old at Harvard University, where he's offering some advice to the young set. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. It's considered the hottest and driest place in North America, but this year, California's Death Valley has seen a lot of rain, so much so that sleeping seeds have woken up. Death Valley is now full of color, covered with carpets of California poppies, evening primrose, and yellow pepperweed, just to name a few of the wildflowers making an appearance this spring. Eileen Anderson is a botanist with the California Native Plant Society. Eileen, what does the floor of Death Valley look like right now?
There is a profusion of beautiful wildflowers, primarily in the yellows and golds to the blues and purples.
And this is because of the unusual spring weather you've had, correct?
Death Valley generally gets a little bit less than 2 inches of rain as their annual rainfall. And this year they've got three times that, topping out at a whopping 6 inches. It's really stimulated germination, particularly of the annual plants, which are primarily our beautiful wildflowers. Mm-hmm. And they are experiencing a lake in the bottom of Death Valley. Bad water has become a large lake that people are kayaking. And the wildflowers around the lake are just stunning.
So have you ever seen anything like this?
Never. And I'm expecting not to see anything like it in my lifetime again. It's probably a once-in-a-lifetime event.
Do you know how many species of native plants there are in Death Valley?
Right now, Death Valley has cataloged a little over 1,000 native plant species. That's about one-sixth of our total native plant species in California. But it's also a 3.3 million acre park, so it's a large piece of California. And they are blessed with a variety of plants, and that's primarily based on their geographic diversity, where at Badwater they're almost 300 feet below sea level, and the park goes up to over 11,000 feet at Telescope Peak. So they have a great diversity of plants based on where those plants live in the park.
Can you explain to me how all this rain, activated dormant seeds in the park, or how did it work exactly?
Well, generally in the desert, what the plants are adapted to is these very high temperatures and not very much water. So when seeds are produced, most plants produce them with a sort of waxy covering or cuticle around the seed. Those seeds are living things. And what's necessary for those plants, for those seeds to germinate, is the rains to come and wash off that waxy cuticle and covering, and that allows the seeds to germinate. Because we've had so much rain this year, those seeds, they're waxy protective coating has been washed away, and so we have a huge germination event. And in fact, when you go out there, you'll see, even with the annual plants, some of them germinated early in the spring and some of them a little bit later. So it's sort of this staggered germination event. So hence the longevity of the bloom out there.
What are some of the favorite plants you've seen?
Oh, some of my favorites out there are plants called the gravel ghosts, and these are plants that put up a flowering stalk and then a profusion of white dandelion-type flowers on the tips of the stalk. And you can't really see the stalk because it's kind of a gray-green, and so it looks like there are these little white flowers just hovering about a foot above the soil surface. And when the wind blows, they just sort of look like these little ghosts that are hovering above the surface.
How long will the flowers be around?
The flowers should be around, through July, and it depends on where you go in Death Valley. Right now, at the lowest levels there, below sea level, it's been pretty warm. It's been getting into the 90-degree Fahrenheit range, and so the plants are sort of drying up now. But the wonderful thing about Death Valley is that it has incredible peaks over 11,000 feet. So you can go there in July and see beautiful wildflowers at the highest elevations. The bloom will follow the elevation gradient of the sides of the valley in Death Valley. So they'll have a great year all the way through July.
Oh, sounds wonderful. I think we need to make a field trip.
I agree.
Eileen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Eileen Anderson is with the California Native Plant Society. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Now. With two new CDs coming out next month, there's just no stopping 86-year-old jazz pianist Hank Jones. For more than six decades, Hank Jones has been tickling the ivories, often as a sideman to many of the greats in jazz, including Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday, John Coltrane, and Coleman Hawkins. His resume is impressive when you take into account the 17 years he spent as staff pianist for The Ed Sullivan Show. Hank Jones has played with thousands of performers. For 4 days last week, Harvard University paid tribute to Jones, who in turn led an afternoon session called Learning from Performers.
There's an exercise that I do that I made up myself, you know. You just do this. Up and down the keyboard.
Now, two young and unknown Harvard students can add to their resume that they played with Hank Jones. Before speaking to the man himself, Here and Now producer April Peavy spoke with the two budding musicians.
My name's Charlie Frogner. I'm a junior here at Harvard. I've been playing piano since I was 6 years old, and I'm 21 right now.
My name is Corey Bernhard. I'm a senior here. I'm 22, and I'm about to graduate economics concentrator.
So both of you had a chance to play with Hank Jones. What was that like?
Man, it was exhilarating and terrifying and intimidating and joyful all at once, and it was a rush.
Well, that was terrifying. I mean, he's just such a master that, you know, I figure my notes aren't worthy, you know, to be on the same stage as his, but, I mean, that was quite an experience.
Both those gentlemen are very fine talents. They both have exceptional talent.
I was talking to them afterwards, and they were scared. They were really intimidated.
Oh, I don't know why. I don't know why. They both performed beautifully, you know, really, but they did exceptionally well here.
Well, I guess they were intimidated in part because when one looks at your resume, you have played with everyone from Charlie Parker to Ella Fitzgerald, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw. Do you remember the days when, early on in your career, when you felt intimidated performing with the likes of Charlie Parker or Ella Fitzgerald?
Exactly. When I first came to New York, I heard the Charlie Parker group. They were playing right across the street from the club I was playing in, called the Onyx Club on 52nd Street. They work at a place called the Three Deuces. Well, before I started to work at the Onyx Club, I used to go down there to listen to them. And intimidated is hardly the word. Maybe if there's a word that expresses greater consternation than intimidation, that's what I had. And then when I had to play with them, I was even more so, I was affected. Because I think it's a natural feeling, because these people were at a level that I was trying to reach. They were so far above me musically that you had to be apprehensive about it.
You are known for your improvisation, as is Ella Fitzgerald, and you were her accompanist for 5 years, I believe?
About 5 years.
Would you say that Ella was one of your teachers?
Definitely. She taught by example. I learned a lot about the art of accompanying, and that's what it is. You know, it's not like playing in a small group. It's definitely not playing in a big band. You know, it's not even like playing solo. It's a separate art. It's not in and of itself, because you cannot interfere with the train of thought. You can't lead. You have to follow. You have to play the appropriate fills and the appropriate backgrounds for them to support the singer. That's why you're there. That's what the company says, you know.
But in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream of me.
Buzz, 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 buzz.
For 17 years, you were the staff pianist for CBS, which led you to working on the Jackie Gleason Show, the Ed Sullivan Show.
And also I played two radio shows during the week. And also, there were people who came, you know, to CBS to see if they could audition for a job there or in some show or something. And they would come and I would play their auditions. Sometimes they would bring arias from the opera, you know. But sometimes they wanted these arias transposed up a third or down a third, you know, up a fourth. You know. So you had to do it because that was part of your job. You know.
I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree.
What was it like working on the Ed Sullivan Show every Sunday night?
Thing. You know, we played for a lot of different kinds of acts. Sometimes I used to rehearse for the before I joined the Sullivan Show, I used to rehearse with the singers who appeared on that show prior to the show. So I got a lot of work, a lot of experience working with singers.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone.
You come from a very musical family. Your parents were amateur musicians, but your brothers.
Well, I had Thad, Elvin, but those were the two who went into the business professionally.
Elvin and Thad.
That's right. Thad and Mel Lewis formed a big band called the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Band. And Elvin had his own group. Elvin was the youngest member of the family, by the way.
And a very famous drummer.
Yeah, very, very famous.
And what did you learn in particular from each one? Thad first.
Well, Thad was a very great arranger, as you probably know. And just being able to just play his arrangements was a lesson in and of itself, you know, because they were so innovative and different for the era.
And Elvin?
Elvin was an innovator because he created a style of playing that a lot of drummers have emulated. His ideas of rhythm and solo work were outstanding, you know, and you had to come away with something. Music, playing music is really an exchange of ideas. And when you boil it down, that's one of the aspects of it that I think is the most beneficial, because both parties learn. If I can, out of the depth and breadth, let's say, of my experience, I can pass on something to the youngsters, I'm too glad to do it. I'm very happy to be able to do that. Because that's how the art is furthered. The young people today are the ones who are going to be the performers of tomorrow.
Jazz pianist Hank Jones speaking with Here and Now producer April Peavy. Hank's two CDs coming out next month are For My Father and Joyous Encounter with Joe Lovano. For more information, check out our website at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a good weekend and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.